And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And today we're going to talk about some matters to do with refugees in Africa. We're going to be talking to Thomas Mountain, who is one of our favorite guests. He's in Eritrea. And Thomas is following issues of Somalia, Ethiopia, and the role of Hollywood movie stars in trying to help refugees, allegedly. So he has an issue with Angelina Jolie. We're going to hear about that. And we will talk also to a woman on Wall Street who is one of the people occupying Wall Street to find out why she joined in that and what her assessment of the issues are. And she has an intriguing name, Ray. We're going to talk to Ray on Wall Street. And we, at the latter part of the program, we're going to talk to Chris Black, Toronto lawyer, who very successfully, brilliantly defended General Dindilimana, a major figure in Rwanda in the 1994 events. And you will remember, perhaps last week on this show, we talked with a former representative of the present government of Paul Kagame of Rwanda, the so-called RPF government. On our program last week, this representative, former representative, said that he was witness to acknowledgments by the RPF leadership that they had been involved in the assassination of the president of Rwanda at that time, President Habyarimana. Now, that interview we did with Dr. Rudasingwa has caused quite a bit of controversy or discussion, and we're going to be talking to Chris Black, who is engaged with this issue for quite a period of time. He's going to tell us about those witnesses in his case that confirmed exactly what Dr. Rudasingwa told us, because this is not going to boil down to the evidence of one individual. He's a very important individual, and it's really interesting that he has come forward and is saying what he is saying. But others have said this, including, by the way, Michael Horrigan, who worked for the United Nations. We're trying to reach Thomas now. Just to further on this, I want to make sure I mention something that appeared in the Toronto media, because we really, one of the reasons we do community radio is we don't believe that the mainstream media always gets it right, and indeed they seem to play a kind of a propaganda role often. And we've just had the ugly matter of the bombing of Libya in the name of saving civilians, and many civilians have now been killed, and the infrastructure of that country has been very badly damaged, and there are people who think that was somehow defensible. But there was a story, just to show how you can get into trouble in the modern world, in the Toronto Star of Saturday, September 24. This was a story. Here's the headline. Syria. Activist's teen sister beheaded in custody. And it says, human rights group says regime targeting activist families. Now, and the story went on to tell an awful tale about a young woman who allegedly had been picked up by the Syrian authorities. As we know, there's political turmoil in Syria, and there are the people who believe in the responsibility to protect her and to try to organize a war on Syria to sort them out. And so a headline of this kind plays a really helpful role for those who want to start trouble with Syria. And the story said that she had been taken from her home by the police, that she had been tortured, that she had been murdered, that her head had been chopped off, and that her body had been dismembered. And confirming this, or at least saying they thought it was true, was Amnesty International and the American-based Human Rights Watch. Well, it turns out she's fine. That now, there's a new headline that appeared in the Star, and this would be October the 6th, is about a month later. And it says, no, probably about 2 weeks. It says, Syrian TV interview cast doubt on beheading. That sounds like something from Onion. Yes, if you interview somebody who has not been beheaded, that would tend to cast doubt on the beheading story. But that's the kind of world we live in. if you want to see this woman, she's available. There are clips of her talking, and she's very much alive, and she's very much infuriated that people have used her in this way. But that shows you, and that was Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, who was trying to build a fire based on this fairy tale about the woman. Anyway, we're joined now, I believe, by Thomas Mountain. Are you there, Mr. Mountain?
Yes.
Hey, it's good to hear your voice, and you're in Eritrea, and I'm sorry we're keeping you up late. And we need to talk to you because I was just telling the story, and you may have heard about it, the Syrian, young Syrian woman who allegedly had been beheaded, and Amnesty and others were beating the drums that, of course, now is the time to get ready for to do a Libya on Syria. But she shows up on television. She's okay. You have similar complaints about Western media and cultural icons and whatnot, altering stories or shaping stories. Let's start with the one. You've written an article about Angelina Jolie. And, of course, by the way, you can tie any of these pieces together if you like. But Angelina Jolie is a big figure in the United Nations High Commission on Refugees. And she's been talking about Somalians. But you have a bone to pick with her on that.
Yes. Well, you know, for the last 10 years, Angelina Jolie has been the goodwill ambassador for the High Commission for Refugees and Humanitarian Commission for Refugees. And 2 years ago, she held a press conference and demanded that the United States declare war and start bombing Sudan. So she claimed that she was doing this to protect the people of Darfur. So, you know,
how does she keep it?
She's so full of.
How do they keep their jobs when they pull stunts like that? I mean,
well, I think they just prefer that everybody forget it happened because, you know, it's highly weird. They know it. They're trying to take advantage of it all. She was in Somalia last week, holding a press conference to announce that with crocodile tears rolling down her face, announcing that 750,000 Somalis were starving and that we had to do something. It was a desperate situation. And she never mentioned the fact that her colleagues at the UN just a few months ago had been cutting food rations to 30% of the minimum daily survival needs of a million Somali refugees in these camps. Hmm. Now, 30%, that's slow starvation. And the reason they given for this was there was a funding shortfall. Now, she didn't mention the fact that these million refugees were not victims of drought. They were victims of wars that the United Nations had funded and instigated, starting with the Ethiopian invasion in 2006 to destroy any chance of peace in Somalia when the Union of Islamic Courts came to power in Mogadishu. And then when the Ethiopians were driven out of Somalia by the Somali resistance, the United Nations sent the Ugandan and Burundian troops in. And by now, the Ugandan and Burundian troops, there was no funding shortfall for the tanks and the helicopter gunships and the heavy artillery they used, have literally flattened about 30 square miles of Mogadishu. Now, can you imagine if they flattened 30 square miles of Toronto, if the United States Army came in and occupied Toronto and flattened 30 square miles? There's 500,000 refugees there, maybe more, right?
Yeah, and we'd know they were refugees, too.
That's right. So they've got a million Somalis in these camps. The UN says, we've run out of money, and so we're going to cut their food rations to 30%. Of what they need to survive, that slow starvation. Angelina Jolie had nothing to say about that. And it turns out that the funding shortfall that they're talking about is not that much more than what Angelina Jolie makes per pitch per one of her films, mm-hmm. her Hollywood films, about $15 million or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's all a bit much because right next door to Somali in southeast Ethiopia, which is inhabited by Somali people. I mean, every major clan and sub-clan that's found in Somali proper is found in the Ethiopian Ogaden.
Yeah. By the way, Thomas, if I could just ask you, this is Thomas Mountain, by the way, and please just check his articles on all these matters, but shouldn't we, I mean, if they were really concerned on just on that issue of the poor, the status of refugees, an actual reporter would always link those two countries, wouldn't they? If they're going to talk about the region, you have to talk about both sides of the border. To talk about only one side doesn't make sense.
Right, and the thing is, see, I mean, maybe, why didn't Angelina Jolie talk about, I mean, it was just some months back, that another United Nations organization, the Famine Early Warning System, had been saying that millions of Somalis in the Ogaden, southeast Ethiopia, were starving. So it's not like if she works for the UN, it's not like it's a secret. It's not like these UN people aren't saying this. They're starving in the Ogaden. Before they announced they were starving in Somalia, they were announcing that they were starving in the Ogaden. But now it turns out that cholera has broken out in the Ogaden. Now, cholera is a deadly disease, but very treatable. But it turns out that for 4 years now, the Ethiopian government, headed by Nella Sonali, has expelled the Doctors Without Borders and the International Committee for the Red Cross from the Ogaden. So there's nobody there to treat this cholera. So and they've also, the Ethiopian government's also put a food aid blockade on the region. And so this is actually a genocide's going on there, but not a word out of Angelina Jolie. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because she doesn't want to offend Nella Sonali, who it's reported personally greeted her when she came to Ethiopia to buy or adopt her baby, mm-hmm. the Ethiopian daughter she adopted some years back. And, you know, it's very interesting because maybe that baby's not an orphan. I mean, the Ethiopian government sells about 3,000 babies every year in Ethiopia.
Yikes.
And minimum price is about $30,000. Just about anybody can buy a baby in Ethiopia. And it's put about $500 million in the pockets of the Nella Sonali regime. Of the 30,000 they collect per baby, maybe 1,000 gets back to the baby's family. And many of these families are still alive, that they're actually selling their babies because they're starving. It's a way to get enough money to survive for a couple of years by selling their babies. So maybe Angelina Jolie's baby, we don't know. Maybe his family's still alive in Ethiopia. Maybe they sold that baby to her via the Ethiopian government to survive, to eat.
Yeah.
So
incredible.
Angelina Jolie showed up. Nella Sonali expedited the case. Maybe she didn't want to embarrass him. So let's not talk about the genocide in Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's full of goodwill, you know?
Now, Thomas, you know, a question I have on this that you must have thought about it, is that how does Hollywood get the monopoly on these prestigious humanitarian jobs, which always turn out to be highly politicized? I noticed, for example, that Angelina Jolie visited Syrian refugees in Turkey, which is a very sensitive issue because there's a chance of Turkey attacking Syria and using the refugees as a pretext. But on the first thing, I don't know of any Russian or Indian actors that have these prominent roles. How come Hollywood gets them?
Well, there was an interesting story in Counterpunch by Afshin Mirtansi of the Double Standards television program on Press TV, which I would recommend all your listeners to check out, Double Standards on Press TV.
Mm-hmm.
He had a story about how one of the reportedly mentors of Angelina Jolie's career, as well as her husband Brad Pitt, is a guy named Arnon Mishan, mm-hmm. who turns out is a big Hollywood producer. It turns out it's actually an Israeli, according to a book written by two former Israeli Mossad secret agents. He was an Israeli secret agent, intelligence agent, that was basically sent to Hollywood with a bunch of cash to help set up fund the Israeli raise funds and to provide a front for the Israeli nuclear weapons program way back in the 1970s.
That's quite a history for a Hollywood producer or whatever. Or is he an agent?
Yeah.
Well, I mean literally theatrical agent, or
he's a Hollywood producer, and I'm not sure just what, you know, whether he was an agent as well, but according to these two former insiders in the Israeli secret service, the Mossad, he was actually funded and set up by ISIS, a part of the Israeli government that was so secret that the democratic Israeli government portion never even knew about it, and that his job was to secretly provide, to buy kryptons, which are the triggers for the nuclear devices, and to help us get the uranium from South Africa. Yeah. And it's reported in the late 1970s that the Israelis, with the cooperation of the South Africans, set off a nuclear weapon in the Indian Ocean, South Indian Ocean. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Angelina Jolie has got these kind of connections. You know, it appears like the United States and the Canadian government are pretty much, sometimes it appears like they're wings of the Israeli government. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that might help explain it all, you know. Yeah. I mean,
And we have people like, I mean, one of the first interviews we did with you, and this is Thomas Mountain, was we were talking about George Clooney. And he got himself, I mean, he's not just a guy sort of on the fringe. He put himself right in the middle of all these accusations. He organized rallies. And that was they created the myth of there was a genocide going on in Darfur. And then they backed away or forgot about it. Then he got involved in South Sudan. But all the time, I mean, these are people who basically, they're like Human Rights Watch. They operate out of the U.S., and you have to assume even that they were just by osmosis, but they tend to reflect the point of view of the U.S. State Department.
Well, you know, I think they live in this sort of their little bubble, and people like Anna and Michon, they're feeding them their, like, mushrooms. You know, keep them in the dark and feed them horse manure. George Clooney and Brad Pitt and Steven Spielberg, among others, spent something like $1 million buying satellite time to watch the Northern Sudanese army, whether they were actually going to come in and create a genocide in South Sudan during the last election. Mm-hmm. Now, South Sudan's one of the poorest countries on the planet. You know, $1 million could have saved thousands and thousands of lives of South Sudanese children just by providing them with clean drinking water or basic you know, food supplies or medication to treat malaria or typhoid or other things like this. And instead, they take this $1 million, hundreds of thousands at least, and spend it buying satellite time to watch the concentrations of North Sudanese troops. Wait a second. You know, these guys are like, what's wrong with these guys? If you're going to spend all this money, save children's lives.
Yes, exactly. And by the way, they're warmongering in the sense that clearly the idea was that if they told us that according to their satellite information, the Sudanese were misbehaving, then that would call for NATO to do something.
Well, you know, all along they've been pushing for NATO to do something, to get boots on the ground in Sudan. You know, I just to review briefly with your listeners, there was, you know, everybody heard this huge brouhaha about there was a genocide in Darfur in West Sudan. And I'd written a few times about this because, you know, the whole claims that hundreds of thousands have been killed in this Darfur by the North Sudan was, you know, basically bogus. There's no evidence to prove any of that. Mm-hmm. That was just that when you really investigate it all, you get down to somebody said in the UN. Yeah. And the people that said it are a really dodgy credibility. And the fact is that, and this is a fact, that all the aid agencies that were on the ground in Darfur helping the victims of the Darfur conflict, because there was a conflict, and there was tens of thousands, maybe 30,000 people killed in the Darfur conflict, and this is going back in 2003, 2004. It all pretty much ended by 2005. The victims of the Darfur conflict were the beneficiaries of the largest, best-run relief works in history, and that without the support and leadership of the president of Sudan, President al-Bashir, this would not have been possible. In other words, at the same time that Bashir was supposed to be murdering hundreds of thousands of people, he was also playing a critical role in the success of the largest best-run relief effort in history that was saving hundreds of thousands of people's lives. So we know that there was a very successful relief effort. We know Bashir played a critical role in that. That's undisputable. Mm-hmm. And yet, what they cannot prove is that hundreds of thousands died in Sudan. So that's why I say, you know, we've got to bury the Darfur genocide myth. And that there was George Clooney, just a year or two back, going out there waving the flag, saying, hey, America's got to come in here and yes. invade, put boots on the ground.
And Jolie.
Wait a second.
Yes. No, that's very... that's my favorite phrase of yours. Wait a second. But, of course, that's how demonization works, doesn't it? I mean, the demonization of the president of Sudan was so successful that actually even if you were to compliment him on something good, that becomes somehow a reason to dislike him more. Right? In other words, they say the devil is providing the food. And they say, well, yeah, but he's doing that to cover himself. Well, what do you know?
Well, you know, President Bashir is no angel, and I've actually been very critical of him in the past. And I'm very harsh on him in the past, but he started to play a more positive role in Sudan. And, of course, that was brought about by Eritrea, and that's another story altogether. The true story of what's actually the peace process in Sudan is something that I've written about in an article called Storm Clouds Over South Sudan. But, you know, that's something that's going to be continuing to unfold. You know, the U.S. is very heavily involved in South Sudan. They've got... They're paying the salaries of the South Sudanese military now for 2 years, $100 million a year. All of the military salaries in South Sudan are being paid by the Americans. Mm-hmm. Ethiopians have got close to 10,000 quote-unquote peacekeepers on the border between North and South Sudan, which is also where the Sudanese oil fields are in Abyei. And, of course, the United States is paying for all these Ethiopian peacekeepers there. So, I mean, there's a lot of things developing. We'll have to wait and see. But I'm very pessimistic about what the U.S. is up to in Sudan, which is the largest, was the largest and potentially richest country in Africa until this division took place.
Yeah, and that was such a curious event. I mean, the son of Billy Graham was one of the key people there to say that it was a good thing, what was going on. Of course, he had been there. Source of the great legend about how the Muslims were taking Christians and making them slaves, and he was there for this.
A lot of things, you know, during the Sudanese civil war, a lot of really nasty things went on, but it had come to an end, and it came to an end in 2005 when the Sudanese peace deal was signed between John Garang, the founder of the South Sudanese. Sudanese People's Liberation Army and its political wing, the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that John Garang, after the peace deal was signed, he went to Khartoum in Sudan, North Sudan, for the first time and spoke in front of over a million people. Now, President Bashir had never spoken in front of more than 100,000. John Garang in the North spoke to over a million people. And what did he say? He said, he is against independence for South Sudan. The father, what they call the father of South Sudanese independence, was vehemently against independence. He said, I'm going to be elected president of as a united, independent country of Sudan. We're going to continue working with the Chinese to develop our oil industry, and we're going to have equal rights and justice for all Sudanese.
Then he got on a helicopter and disappeared.
Sudanese helicopter is dead. Right now, we've got South Sudanese, South Sudan independent, and a disaster. Mm-hmm. It's just a disaster. There's a huge ethnic conflict there. And we don't hear George Clooney, Angela Jolie saying, hey, what a disaster it's turned out to be. No. We've got to send American troops to declare war and bomb Sudan.
Yeah. By the way, I have to just say, Thomas, that when I think about Jolie and Clooney and people like that, it seems to me they're almost the cultural equivalent of Blackwater. I mean, they just function so nicely on behalf of
right.
U.S. interests.
That's a good idea. Well, I'll have to remember that one, Phil. Yeah, Angela Jolie, cultural equivalent of Blackwater. That's a good one.
Yeah. Hey, let me ask you now, lastly, because you and I, the last few times, were talking about the events in Libya. Flash takeover, the great democratic struggle, it's still a blasted mess, and NATO is still flying missions. I think, what is it? It's up around 20,000 missions with 10,000 strikes, I think, at this point. What do you think of this humanitarian, what do they call it? Responsibility to protect.
Yeah, responsibility to protect. Well, you know, this evening I was watching BBC World News, and they are saying that the insert, which is they are claiming is about to be conquered by the rebels, they'd actually, the pro-Qaddafi forces, the loyalist forces, they call them now, had actually recaptured the University of Sirte from these rebel fighters. But that's what BBC was saying. So, in other words, these pro-democracy revolutionaries are, that are basically, you know, surrounding and slaughtering the people of Sirte. I mean, they shelled their hospital and massacring people, cut off all their food and water, aren't really much of a fighting force. And I think probably as I'm speaking, the NATO bombers are bombing the university again.
Yeah.
Because without NATO, people haven't been able to win a single battle.
Yeah, this is just it. It's NATO with some hired guys on the ground. And as a result, it's very messy. They can't do it. You know, this is the people they're backing there are seem to be kind of a gang, and even the gang has trouble with each other.
They've already started fighting each other, and there've been reports that they've been fighting each other in Tripoli. The leadership of the Benghazi and the Tripoli military councils are leaders of the Islamic Maghreb, the Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb. And they've been all embraced. You know, the chief of the Islamic Maghreb was the head of the military council in Tripoli. He'd been in Afghanistan, supported by the CIA, fighting the Soviet Union. And then after that, he ended up in Iraq, head of one of the leaders of the Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And what were they doing? They were recruiting and training suicide bombers in Iraq to go out and slaughter tens of thousands of Shia civilians. This guy was one of those that was running the suicide bomber program in Iraq. And they're going in and bombing civilians. Tens of thousands of Shia civilians were slaughtered. He got to the point where even the Sunni got fed up with him so much that he had to leave Iraq. Everybody was sick of these guys. And he ended up in Malaysia, where the CIA had him kidnapped and sent to Thailand. And then they made a deal with Qaddafi, and they sent him back to Libya. Now, interestingly enough, everybody wants to blame Qaddafi for all this, but he ended up back in Libya. And who was he under? Whose control was he under? General Yunus, the Minister of the Interior, who was head of the secret police. This is the guy that he turned around and murdered in revenge and so that he wouldn't have any opposition in controlling these rebel military forces. And, of course, blame it all on Qaddafi, right? But it turns out all these National Transitional Council leadership, whereas the very people that are doing all the crimes, they blame Qaddafi for.
Yeah. Now that's, of course, the logic of demonization. It works like a charm. No matter what you say, you've already marked a guy. This is the bad guy. Everything lands on him. Thomas, we're really glad to be talking to you. We posted your last article, and I think we'll post at the Taylor-Report. We're going to post this article you've written about Angelina Jolie. You're doing great work in Eritrea. We're awfully glad to talk to you. Sorry we kept you up late.
That's all right. You know, I think I've got another one coming out here about how the president of Liberia is just received a co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes.
And you know that the capital city in Monrovia in Liberia has had no running water for all the years that she's been president. Capital city has no running water.
That's how you get a Nobel Prize. And by the way, they don't mention
she
was defeated in election.
Liberia was one of the main bases for these paramilitary death squads that invaded Ivory Coast. And carried a massacred untold thousands, 800 people in one town alone. And you get a peace prize for hosting paramilitary death squads that go next to your neighbors and massacre thousands of people.
Oh, that's a great story.
I mean, you know, Liberia, she's actually just the mayor of Monrovia. She's not even the president of Liberia.
Well, and she can't keep the...
Liberia is run by warlords.
Yeah, she's a mayor and she can't keep the lights on.
And you can't even get provide drinking water in how many years she's been there.
And, but, well,
in any case, yeah, Phil, good to be on, man.
Well, it's great talking to you, Thomas, and we'll talk to you soon, and we're going to run the article if you put it up there.
Okay, thanks, Phil.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, Toronto.
Yeah. No. Yeah, bye-bye. That's Thomas Mountain. He's from Eritrea, and he's done a lot of great writing. You often find him in Counterpunch. We've reprinted him at taylor-report.com. I'm glad he mentioned the president of Liberia getting the Nobel Prize. The first prize she got, of course, was the permanent job for the World Bank, which she received. And after she became a World Bank employee, they decided they had to get her to help remove Charles Taylor. She ran against Charles Taylor in 1997, was defeated. And she never claimed any, I mean, she didn't say it was a fake election. She just plain lost it. He was never defeated in an election. Instead, there was a coup, and you'd have to ask George Bush Jr. how they did that one. But yes, she's a World Bank employee, like the guy who is now running Ivory Coast, another World Bank employee. How do they get these jobs? Give it 2 years, and the guy in Ivory Coast will be getting a Nobel Prize. So I'll remind you, this is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT. It's 89.5 FM. And listen, next Monday on the 17th, we're going to be kicking off our fundraising. And we know you want to be in on that. You know the value of alternative radio, community radio. We do things like we do today. We speak to a man in Eritrea about the realities on the ground there in countries like Somalia, Ethiopia. And we will, and later we're going to be talking to someone who's on Wall Street. I mean, that's the kind of thing we do. So this is a CIUT, and it's a Taylor Report. And you can check us out, taylor-report.com, where you see some of the articles published by the people that we are speaking to. But fundraising time begins on the 17th, and we really look forward to getting support from our listeners and we'll be talking about that again later, but we're joined now by Ray, who is in New York and who's been one of the people occupying Wall Street. How are you, Ray?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
It's great to talk to you because you're one of the people. You're a veteran. How early? I mean, this has been going on. I'm losing track. A couple of 3 weeks, and the occupation has been taking place.
Mm-hmm. It started on the 17th. I actually lost track of how many days that has been a while ago. But I think it's been about 3 weeks, and I was there on day one. So I've been in it since the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Well, why did you, what caused you to go and participate in this Wall Street? I mean, what's the magic of saying Occupy Wall Street?
Well, to be honest, I feel a lot of people that came on that first day in September weren't entirely sure what they were getting themselves into. I've been traveling for a little while. I'm coming by way of Boston, and I was in Washington, D.C., and I heard, you know, mostly through the Internet, like something called Occupy Wall Street, that people were going to set up tents on Wall Street and Occupy and kind of, you know, make a big deal about how Wall Street's, Wall Street's control over, people's lives around the world. And, like, I guess I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And my friend and I just kind of got on a bus to come up to check it out. I'm coming because my personal beef with corporations is I'm an environmentalist and, energy companies and the banks that finance their projects seem to have a complete lack of regard for life on the planet. They're seemingly getting a lot of money for just making the planet unlivable for you and I and every other thing that needs the earth to live. So that was my kind of reason for going, but I've definitely been hearing everyone else's original reasons for coming and then reasons for staying.
That must be a very exciting thing to go. I mean, you must be meeting a lot of interesting people. You spent the day there, right? And meeting people you've never seen before. What are they like? What's memorable in among the people you meet?
Oh, wow. The first day that we like kind of rallied, there was about 2,000 people. But at the end of the day, when people kind of looked at each other and said, "Well, are we going to stay in this park?" And we're like, "All right, let's just stay here, like see what happens." I mean, there's probably about a couple hundred, and it fluctuated that first week. You know, if there's a rainy day, and there's about 40 of us. So it was like the first group of people were like really just, I don't know, kind of really motivated by like the uncertainty of what we were getting ourselves into and how we could create.
Yeah, I have to say that first group are kind of like, I mean, that is the toughest job, right? To hang on and to be credible and to be a rallying point. It takes a lot of grit to do that.
Yeah, I mean, those people are definitely folks that for the most part had some experience in some form of activism. A lot of the folks were involved with Bloombergville, which happened in New York a few months prior. I don't actually know too much about Bloombergville, but I know that they was an occupation that a few of the original organizers of Occupy Wall Street were part of. So they had experience with occupations. You know, some people even like involved with the occupations at the New School in New York. And then there were people who had traveled from far away to be a part of this. And some people had traveled from far away to stay in New York indefinitely. You know, to see whatever was going to happen all the way through.
Yeah.
So that first group of people were like really my inspiration for staying. And, you know, we cooperated very well and started building the framework for what the camp would look like and how we were going to run the General Assemblies, which is our decision-making body, building a schedule, you know, for marches and meetings and food and that first week, the people that I met were just, you know, very inspiring. And a lot of them are still around, but the camp itself and the people that are there has grown immensely. You know, we're at a point where it's almost difficult to find a place to be in the park. So, you know, I between that point and now, I've met, like, hundreds of people that are here for so many various reasons.
Some must be kind of like soldiers, kind of marking the number of days they've served. Ray, is it like a town? Is there a place you kind of go and say, well, what's today's news? Because the news is starting to pour in, isn't it? I mean, you're getting support in Washington, demonstrations, Los Angeles, Chicago. By the way, there's talk of one here in Toronto, I think, on the 15th of October.
I mean, I lost count. I had a friend, Robert, who has been there since the first day, and he was kind of keeping track. And last number I saw, which was a week ago, was 148 occupations around the country and around 30 around the world. But I know that number is probably closer to like 200 in this country and probably about like 40 around the world. I heard that Occupy Puerto Rico started a couple of days ago. You know, like people are really, you know, I don't think it's like, it's kind of a solidarity action. All these other occupations are in solidarity with what we're doing in Wall Street. But, I mean, I see it as Wall Street affects everybody, you know. Like, the decisions made on Wall Street affect everyone no matter where you are. You can pinpoint in your town, like, people are getting their houses foreclosed on. You know, these group of students are, like, racked with debt and can't find jobs. Or, like, you know, somebody's hydrofracking on the Delaware River Basin. It's like, well, I can pinpoint in my area where Wall Street is affecting. And, like, tons of people are coming from out of town to New York, but I think what's more important is people take it back to where they are and try to, like, fight where they are.
Mm-hmm. Some say that that what has caused this is a disconnect between the so-called electoral process, as opposed to, you know, the democratic way of choosing leaders. Those people who are serving in Congress and the Senate and whatnot are so distant from people that they've decided to go to Wall Street. Do you think that's part of this?
So my personal belief is that, like, I don't think voting or the usual way of what we think to call democratic politics is working. And what we are trying to establish is like a real participatory direct democracy. I guess it's getting a little bit off of what you were asking. I believe that, you know, once somebody is like kind of given power over a group of people like that, the power can become very corrupt, especially when money becomes a part of it. You know, my first couple of days, people were asking me why we weren't in Washington originally. And my answer was always, well, I believe the politicians are in the pockets of the corporations, you know, and that, like, we have tried to, like, look to them to look out for our best interest as the people in this country or around the world. But it's we're always, like, disappointed, you know? And it like goes beyond disappointment. It feels like betrayal, and that the health and safety and just the ability for all of us to be allowed to have our, you know, minimal rights and needs met that were often, you know, sold out completely because of that. So I believe that the way that we're choosing people to lead, to kind of lead over us, is useless. And in the park, we don't have, you know, people know this, but it's not hierarchical. Nobody's making the decisions for everybody. We decide together so that if people do have problems with what's going on, they're able to voice those concerns and we can address them and try to work through those instead of somebody getting completely exploited in some way and not having a voice in the process. So I don't know if that really answers your question.
No, it's perfect. Hey, by the way, there's been some prominent folks who seem to – I like some of the things that they're saying who have come down. I notice – I've heard that Roseanne Barr, for example, was there. I don't know if you saw her. And by the way, when these someone like Roseanne Barr shows up, is there a rally? Do people go to hear her or is she just come around? Do you have kind of meetings or what happens?
Yeah, that's definitely been something – it's interesting because – now as we're becoming, like, very prominent in the media, I'm not really surprised that a bunch of well-known names are finding their way down to the park. Roseanne came the first day, actually, so I have a little bit of respect for Roseanne for just, like, showing up that, like,
she
weird
sounds,
day. That,
by the way, her message sounds like yours to a large extent. I mean, she's definitely saying don't rely on these people or don't believe them.
She's definitely angry. She's definitely being angry, and it was really, and it was cool seeing her down there. Whatever, people were that first day. Everybody was so boxing, like, this is why I'm here, and you know, we were. So I mean, it wasn't that crazy that she was there, but I mean, recently, like, Michael Moore has been in the park numerous times. Who else? Like, I saw Susan Sarandon was around. We've had like a few. Peter from Peter, Paul, and Mary showed up to play a song. We had some folks from the Zapatista movement. So we've had like a lot of...
So that's good for morale, huh?
I mean, it is. It definitely... I mean, it is. But, you know, by the time they come down, they're basically just like speaking to the choir. You know, like, we need to bring down Wall Street. We're like, we know. That's why I was in here for 3 weeks. You know? But, I mean, it's nice, you know? But the way they can support us is maybe by, you know... sending us some sleeping bags if they have a couple. I don't know, and I guess it's good for press. Like, you get a lot of press coming down. But also a lot of politicians have come down as well, which is an interesting thing.
Sure, there's no harm if they come and face the people. That's good. Let them answer some questions.
It's true, but, what's happening now is some people are labeling us kind of the anti-Tea Party.
No, you've already outdone the Tea Party anyway. That's silly.
Let
the Tea Party look in the mirror and say, we belong down there on Wall Street with those people.
Well, another thing is that folks are seeing us as possibly a movement towards trying to get, like, Obama reelected. But if you go down to the park and talk to most people, part of the reason why we're all really angry is that everybody thought that by electing a Democrat, by electing Obama, everything was going to work out for us. And obviously that's not the case. And I think people's illusions about, like, the electoral system, like, and just, like, getting a, quote-unquote, like, better candidate into the presidency will actually, like, solve our problems mm-hmm. has been, like, really just sadly, like, disappointed, you know,
sure.
That people are kind of angry at Obama and are pointing to him as a reason why, like, no leader is ever going to, like, seemingly ever look out for us, you know, no matter how much they promise. And you know, we'll just, again, sell us out.
Yeah, you have to look, like, after yourselves.
Yeah, so so we're not, like, I'm not for, like, I personally am not for, like, Obama. I'm not for any candidate, and I've already, like, made that clear. And if the Democrats are going to co-opt our movement, I'm going to be kind of upset. I'm going to make that be known, like, personally.
Right. Talking to you, I'm very confident that ain't going to happen. You guys are going to stay focused, I'm sure. Last question, Ray. How about endurance? You guys, they say the other side thinks, oh, they're going to wear you down. How do you feel about it ongoing? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think there's kind of like a two-prong approach. Like, there's kind of like the movement endurance and then just like individual, like, endurance. Because, I mean, it's tough, like, sleeping out in the middle of Manhattan a block away from, like, ground zero construction, you know, the new World mm-hmm. Trade Centers, and, like, you know, eating as well as you possibly can, but also it's getting kind of cold, and, like, it's easy to burn out, like, personally, so it's really about, like, self-care and taking care of each other. We have medics on site who know how to, like, do, like, kind of basic first aid stuff. We have, like, a comfort station that has blankets and extra clothes. And but, like, we're trying to take care of each other as much as possible. As in terms of the movement, I think something has started that I don't see stopping. You know, it's
yeah.
so decentralized at this point. Like, there's no leader. There's no one place where this is all happening. If New York was to, like, stop tomorrow, which it won't, but, like, say it just were to happen, you know, again, there's 200 occupations happening around the country. They're not all going to be like our little, like, satellite spaceships that
exactly.
like crumble when the mothership dies. They're going to like completely
okay.
flourish and do what they need to do where they are. And I think something started that actually won't ever yeah. stop, you know, and I think that's a pretty incredible thing. And that just shows like the power of people doing what they feel they need to do to take care of themselves and govern their own selves.
Good. Well, Ray on Wall Street, more power to you. We look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Yeah, good luck in Toronto.
Okay.
Go get them.
Thank you. All right.
Bye-bye.
And you're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And you can check us out, taylor-report.com. And we're going to be talking to Chris Black. And I'm going to remind you, October the 17th, kickoff for fundraising for CIUT. I know you're going to be enthusiastic, so start doing your calisthenics and getting ready to give us support so they keep this kind of programming and keep a wonderful station like CIUT rolling. So if you get in, if you make a contribution, and you just go CIUT.fm, make a contribution before the 17th, you get in on $1,200 value thing, which is the Center for the Arts. I think I've characterized it right, but believe me, it's really valuable. And you can start contributing now. You don't have to wait around. But we will be doing it officially on the 17th. And I think we're joined now by Chris Black, Toronto lawyer. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, I'm here. How are you doing, Phil?
Not bad, and we're really glad to be talking to you. Last week on this show, I spoke to two individuals from Rwanda. One, a former ambassador under Paul Kagame. His name is Dr. Rudasingwa,
mm-hmm.
and he told us the shocking story that he had himself heard Paul Kagame say that he had directed the shooting down of Habyarimana's plane, which launched the terrible war and loss of life there, which resulted in your becoming a lawyer
right.
in Arusha, Tanzania, at a UN court. And then later in the show, I spoke with the daughter of Habyarimana, and she said, of course, she's very glad and she's very touched that he had come forward. And I had a lot of correspondence, as you would, I'll bet you're not surprised. And there seems to be a kind of a misunderstanding that people are talking as though Dr. Rudasingwa was the only one to have said this, but you were in a courtroom in Arusha, Tanzania, and you had several prominent witnesses talk about the matter of who shot down that plane, or just made reference. Could you talk about that?
Right. Well, there were, in a series of trials at the Rwanda War Crimes Tribunal, there have been a number of important witnesses have testified about that. First of all, of course, the RPF officer, Abdul Ruzabiza, who said he was part of the shoot-down team and confirmed that the RPF shot down the plane, and he took part in that. Alison DeForge, the great expert for the prosecution on and who wrote the book, Leave None to Tell the Tale of the Story, also said in cross-examination that she now thinks that the RPF probably shot down the plane, and that was in 2006.
That's helpful.
Yeah. But the perhaps the most important witnesses are what you might consider neutral ones, UN officers on the scene. In Kigali in April 1994, the Belgian battalion commander, Colonel Luc Marchal, who was the officer in charge of all the UN forces in the city of Kigali itself.
And by the way, his responsibilities covered the airport, right?
And yes, right, because the Belgians were in charge of the airport along with some gendarme customs officers there. He said in his testimony in our trial that he was convinced that the RPF shot down the plane, and there was no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. Now, he's a very important witness.
Yes.
And also Colonel André Vincent, who at that time was Belgian military technical advisor to the Belgian embassy in Kigali, and later became second in command of Belgian Army Intelligence, said that it was no doubt that the RPF shot down the plane. All the evidence pointed to them. Mm-hmm. And he was convinced that was the case. But it's not just that. There was the UN itself, of course, did its own, the ICTR, did its own investigation under Louise Arbour, the Canadian prosecutor. She commissioned a team of investigators to find out who shot down the plane. On the thinking, on the theory, I believe that Hutu extremists did it. Mm-hmm. But the head of her investigative team, Michael Hourigan, is an Australian lawyer, came to her and told her, in fact, that he had found the shoot-down team and had documents and interviews and documentary proof that it was so that it was the RPF that shot down the plane. Now, what the scandal of that is that when he told Louise Arbour that he had found that information, he was summoned to The Hague with a CD-ROM in which he had the material, and he was surprised to find that she told him not to mention it and seized the CD and closed the file down. So,
yikes.
In fact, she covered up Kagame's responsibility for a mass murder. And
people really have to hear that name, Hourigan, and the UN investigation, and
right.
And the fact that it was stopped.
Right. And Michael Hourigan, we filed his affidavit. He wrote an affidavit. It was filed in our trial, in which he said that he later worked at the office oversight in the UN and made a report for them about his report to Louise Arbour, that he had told her who had really shot down the plane, and then she covered it up. Mm-hmm. And he said he felt that there are forces in the UN, dark forces in the United Nations, which were trying to cover up what really happened in Rwanda. And mm-hmm. he resigned in disgust and is now in Australia practicing as a lawyer there.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I had a message from Mr. Hourigan responding to the Rudasingwa matter, mm-hmm. saying, he said someone should speak to Louise Arbour about this.
Yeah, she must explain.
He hasn't forgotten that issue.
No, it's when you think about it, over 20 or so people were murdered on that plane, and that was the first strike of the RPF. That was not just to trigger what they call the genocide. That was the first act of the RPF offensive to take power in April 1994. Mm-hmm. They decapitated the head of state. They killed the head of state of Burundi, another Hutu, and the army chief of staff.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Rudasingwa confirmed that he thought that the motive was that they knew that if the Arusha process went forward, that they could not win in a parliamentary environment.
That's correct, because in the beginning of the war, when the RPF invaded from Uganda, there was among some people some sympathy in the new political parties for them and their aspirations, and people were tired of the sole party, the MRND. Mm-hmm. But as the war proceeded, and as the RPF broke ceasefire after ceasefire after ceasefire, and were massacring Hutus everywhere and nonstop, many people began turning against the RPF, and parties began splitting between pro-RPF and anti-RPF factions, and many people were going back to the MRND. And it was clear, I mean, Colonel Marshall, the Belgian ambassador, and very many other politicians who testified in our trial, said that the only group that opposed the Arusha Accords and put obstacles in its path was the RPF.
Yes. And you know, people said it at the time and tried to say it in the early stages of this legal struggle, and all that was kept under the rug, but it is coming back to haunt them because it's a simple fact. You can't make facts go away.
No, you can't. And in fact, they went further and said that not only was the RPF the only obstacle, for instance, Colonel Marshall, Ambassador Johan Swinnen, the Belgian ambassador there at the time, said that the Rwandan army, the armed forces, and the Rwandan government, and armed forces themselves were pro-Arusha Accord and were willing to do anything to stop the war because they didn't want the war to go on. They were too weak.
Mm-hmm.
But the RPF assassinated the president and launched an attack that very night. And very more, it didn't start 2 days later or 1 day later. It started that night.
Mm-hmm.
There's Belgian officers who reported seeing and being told that an RPF column was going to attack the Presidential Guard barracks that night, and they reported they did. So it wasn't, the RPF didn't attack afterwards to stop the so-called genocide.
Yeah, and it was, yes, and even their military maneuvers showed they weren't even interested in rescuing civilians. That had nothing to do with what they were doing.
No, and a very important fact for people to know is on April 12th, just 6 days after the assassination of the president, the Rwandan army was so taken aback and surprised by this offensive, it was massive,
mm-hmm.
that they felt they were going to lose. So they, to stop the killings, they approached the RPF, several senior officers, including my client, General Danili Amana, and proposed an unconditional surrender. That is, you win, we surrender completely. The RPF rejected that offer. Why would they reject an unconditional surrender? They completely won because the RPF would then have to negotiate with the political parties and the armed forces as another party in the scene and come to an agreement. They didn't want to do that. So Ruzibiza was one of those officers who felt betrayed by Kagame because the war could have stopped in 6 days and nobody would have been killed. None of these killings would have taken place.
Yeah.
But Kagame didn't want that.
This is Chris Black, and he brought all these facts out in court. And, Chris, your client has been practically martyred by this whole process. He's never varied in his story, and now he's basically been acquitted. I think they had him on one count of not failure to properly supervise somebody, which is hideous. But he did many years in prison before now being released, ordered released. But... Well, how many years did he serve, and where is he now? What's going to happen to him?
He served 11 years, and this is a man who the judges why they released him was that not only was he acquitted of all the substantive charges against him, 60. The judges confirmed that this is a unique case, and they wondered why he would be charged in the first place, and that the prosecution had to be questioned about their motivations, because he was a man, and the gendarmerie spent all of his time trying to save lives. His gendarmes tried to save Tutsi and civilian lives everywhere they could.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he saved 37 Tutsi orphans and priests in his own house in Kigali.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they arrested him. And we know he was arrested, put pressure on him to testify against Colonel Bagosora. It was just a game. And he's been 11 years in prison for this.
Yeah.
And no apology.
For failure, unwillingness to provide false evidence against a fellow officer.
Right.
Incredible. Will he be able to, you think he's going to be able to return to his family soon?
Well, that's another problem. General Kabilegi and several other civilian ministers have been acquitted, but they can't go back to their country. General Dilimana, like the rest, is stuck in a safe house in Tanzania, basically in exile. One man, I think, has been there for Andre Ntaganda for 7 years, General Kabilegi for 3 years.
These are people, by the way, Kabilegi is absolutely cleared.
Absolutely cleared. Prote Ziggy Zoranyu, completely cleared.
And
the
country
won't take them back. They can't go anywhere. General Danili Amana has refugee status in Belgium. His family lives there. His one daughter is a lawyer, wife's a nurse, another daughter is a nurse. And he's not allowed to go back. But the Belgian government, despite the fact he was acquitted, and despite the fact that he was welcomed into Belgium by Willy Claes in 1994 as having saved many lives and risked his life to do so, they still won't take him back, and it's all politics, and he's basically stuck in exile.
Wow.
For the rest of them. Well, it's a scandal what the UN does to people.
It is a damn disgrace. Chris Black, it's terrific talking to you. Thanks for clarifying all those issues. Look forward to talking to you again.
All right, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Hi. That's Chris Black, who did a brilliant job of defending General Dindili Mana. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'll remind you now that next Monday, the 17th, we're going to be asking you to contribute to the station and to support the program. And so we look forward to hearing from you. Be on the ball. Be ready. And check us out, taylor-report.com. And I want to thank James very much for all the help. This is Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. See you next week.